Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I do. Okay. We're delighted to welcome here this morning our students from Colby High School. Would they stand? Delighted to have you. Thank you. You may be seated. And we have students from Mayville High School. Would they stand? Delighted to have you also. You may be seated. Students are here with our Caught with Class program. And this program is run by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. It's a national award-winning program. The students have gotten the briefs for this case and may have gotten other materials and done work in the classroom on the case. And a part of the Caught with Class program is that they meet with a justice of the Supreme Court at noon after the second case has been argued. And today that justice will be Justice Bradley. Now let me introduce the court to you all, and I'm going to start on my far right. And seated there is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox. And to his left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. With these introductions made, we will now turn to our first case for today. 00-3074, In Re Commitment of Stephen Burgess, State v. Burgess. We'll hear first from the Assistant State Public Defender, Stephen Weiss, and then we'll hear from Sandra Nowak, the Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Weiss.
Good morning, Your Honors. This case has two sets of issues falling into two fairly distinct categories. First, there are issues concerning Chapter 980. And the Chapter 980 issues include the question of whether or not subjects of Chapter 980 civil commitments should have privacy rights comparable to the privacy rights afforded other persons facing civil mental commitments in the state of Wisconsin under Chapter 51 and Chapter 55, including closed court proceedings, sealed records, and anonymity. As the court knows, those types of cases all proceed by initials rather than names. The second set of issues is a fairly complex set of issues that go to the very underpinnings of how in the real world Chapter 980 cases are tried and litigated. The issue specifically concerns the nature of the proof of a nexus or a connection that's required between the mental disorder finding and the substantial probability that the subject will reoffend. This issue focuses primarily on the use of so-called actuarial instruments, which measure general recidivism without any regard to mental health, and the role that they play in the substantial probability of reoffending determinations. It's our position that because those documents do not consider mental health, substantial probability of reoffending based upon those documents is not sufficient to permit constitutional commitments under Chapter 980. The second set of issues today concerns Indian law and the jurisdiction and the authority of the state of Wisconsin to civilly and involuntarily mentally commit a tribal member who is a legal resident of his own tribal reservation. I'd like to begin with the issue concerning the use of the actuarial instruments. In this case, and I'm going to refer to another case, I'm not going to argue it, but the court should be advised, there's a case pending on a petition for bypass held in abeyance, State versus Proust. It's number 02-0779. They're very closely connected, and they raise the same issue in this regard in slightly different contexts with different states' experts. But both cases together will give the court a broad view of how these cases are tried. What these cases show is that in practice there is no actual nexus or connection made between the existence of the mental disorder and the issue of the substantial probability of reoffending. The state and its experts in these cases routinely blur the very critical distinction between finding that the subject has a mental disorder which predisposes him to commit crimes from the constitutionally required finding that the mental disorder in and of itself creates the substantial probability that one will commit future crimes due to the inability to control one's behavior.
Mr. Weiss, I've got some question about that in this particular case. In this particular case, if I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've got a situation where both of the experts for the state indicate that your client had or was a pedophile, that your client had an antisocial personality, and admittedly they used actuarial instruments as part of their testimony. But as I understand it, they clearly were looking at the fact of the diagnosis of your client, looking at and utilizing actuarial instruments, and then coming to the ultimate conclusion that your client was a dangerous person likely to reoffend. So how can you say there's no nexus here?
I say it, and as I've set out in detail in the briefs, yes, they made diagnoses, and yes, they said that those particular diagnoses that you referred to, pedophilia and antisocial personality, may predispose an individual to commit further crimes. However, at pages 32, I believe, in my brief, at pages 31 through 32, basically, Dr. Fields, who was the state's lead examiner in this case, the state's chief expert, and the only state's expert who did an actual full evaluation, very clearly stated that she did not believe that even the existence of antisocial personality or pedophilia created a predisposition or a diminished ability to control one's behavior. She categorically stated, and I'm going to quote just a sentence from the brief. It's at page 31 of the brief. It's at record 32329. She's asked, well, doesn't pedophilia suggest somebody has an inability to control? And she says, no. Like I just said, just because someone is a pedophile does not mean they act under pedophilia. There are pedophiles who do not molest children.
Yes, and then I want just to raise this question. When you look at the actuarial questions, we're not dealing in this case, and that's true. You know, we'll accept that as true, that there are persons who do not act. Here is a person who has not only acted, but has done so several times on the same, I think we're talking about someone who is 2 years old, 6 years old, nine, whatever I may have. But the point is, in that, in the chart, or the actuarial chart, they go as to times that they have so acted. And I mean, so there is a nexus, it seems to me, between, we're talking about someone who has acted on this disease and this mental illness, and that's one of the factors. So just saying that there are people with pedophilia tendencies who don't act, that may be, but we're not talking about that here, are we?
In this case, he did act.
Yeah.
However, what...
And they base this chart on people that have acted, if I read this correctly. In other words, that's what we're calling the nexus between someone, maybe someone never acted, but this, not only did this person act, but several times. All right. I need to point that out, that is... The
problem, the conceptual problem here, and that's why I said it's kind of a subtle case, the conceptual problem is not whether he's acted, but whether or not our future prediction of his future behavior, which is what these commitments are all about. This court has said countless times upholding the constitutionality that we are in no way punishing someone or increasing his confinement based on his past acts. So what we have in this case, and if the court, I'm not sure how familiar the court has been previously with the actual actuarial instruments, but I have included blank copies of them in the back of the brief. And if we see this, the actuarial instruments, which is the basis for the prediction of the future behavior, don't in any way, shape, or form ever ask, is this future behavior going to be the result of a mental disorder that precludes one or gives one great difficulty in controlling one's behavior? These actuarials will predict future recidivism, but they'll predict the same future recidivism for a profoundly mentally disordered person or a perfectly sane mentally disordered person who is simply an incorrigible criminal. And the U.S. Supreme Court and this Court have stressed in the Crane case and the Laxton case that these commitments are valid only to the extent that they prove beyond a reasonable doubt in Wisconsin that the future behavior, the risk of future offense, flows directly from a mental disorder which carries with it an inability or making it very difficult to control one's behavior. And if I could continue for a moment, that ties directly with the other absolutely overwhelmingly critical evidence in this case, again, from Dr. Fields, the state's doctor. And it's at page 32 of my brief. It carries over from 31. And specifically, she's asked this question, and this is so important to understand the conceptual gap between the prediction of dangerousness and its tying to the mental illness. She's asked, question, and you don't have any reason to think that he, speaking of Mr. Burgess, he's unable to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law, do you? This is the question asked of the state's doctor who evaluated him and came up with her diagnosis. You know what her answer was? I think he can do that from what I have seen. Now, if he can do that from what the state's doctor has seen, he obviously does not and cannot have a mental disorder as required under Crane and Laxton that makes it very difficult or impossible for him to control his behavior. It can't be both ways.
Mr. Weiss, in paragraph 25 of the Court of Appeals decision, the court looked at what I think is the part of Dr. Fields' testimony that you just referred to, and they said that looking at Dr. Fields' totality of the testimony and other parts of it in 25, that she stated she believed Burgess was likely to commit future acts of sexual violence. You see that?
Yes.
Is that just off the wall? There's nothing in the record that would support that she ever said that to?
No, I think she said many things, including parroting the statutory language in response to questions from the prosecutor. But when we delve into what she's actually saying, and if we read the reports of her and of Dr. Knoth, we see that when it really comes time, when it's crunch time, her prediction of his behavior rests exclusively, and they've said this over and over again, on the actuarial instruments. They've said their clinical judgment.
Counsel, when it's crunch time, don't we have to view this evidence to sustain the jury's verdict in a light most favorable to commitment?
If we're looking at it purely as a sufficiency of the evidence case, that is the correct legal standard. However, if we're examining whether this commitment and the whole nature and process of these commitments in Wisconsin with the reliance on the actuarials, I think the court needs to speak to the nexus issue and determine whether or not in general, in its lawmaking authority, whether these type of testimony from these documents are sufficient to prove these cases in the manner in which we've been doing.
My next question is, let's take out, just pretend, that these actuarial documents are not in the case. Is there sufficient testimony aside from the actuarial documents that are going to, in the light most favorable to commitment, sustain the jury's verdict?
I don't think that if the actuarials were there, I don't think there would be, because I don't think the doctors would have given the testimony they gave because they premised all their predictions on those. If I could add particular. Okay. I'm going to interrupt.
All right. We know, I think, that no doctor, no matter how good, can predict this person's behavior with any great certainty. Is that right?
Well, the doctors seem to feel that by use of the actuarials, they can. And there's a wealth of literature that I'm sure this Court has had pointed out to it, where the doctors believe that these actuarials give them a high degree of accurate predictions.
Have there been any evaluations to test these actuarials afterwards? You know, you look at all these people that are released or put in and ultimately released.
No, there haven't been. There have been almost no people released from these statutes to begin with. But what they did with the actuarials is they took, most of them were done in Canada. The MN-SOST was done with a population in Minnesota cross-referenced with the population in Canada. But what they've done in these cases is they simply took people who have reoffended and sought to create a grid or a screening of factors that they have in common. And they feel in the scientific literature that they can pretty accurately predict it. But when you look at these documents, you see how vague and general they are, because those are the only common factors they could actually come up with. The razor, the most commonly used one, lists, have you had a prior sex offense? Well, we wouldn't be here if they hadn't had a prior sex offense. In our case, Mr. Burgess, the next question is age. Over or under 25 years old? Well, he was under 25. He was arrested when he was, I think, 15 or 16, and he's been in the state's custody since. The victim gender is the third question.
Let me, if I might interrupt and follow up on what the Chief was asking you, and it ties into what I asked you originally. Looking at the Court of Appeals decision in paragraph 25, they talk about the fact that during direct examination, Fields offered the belief that Burgess was likely to commit future acts of sexual violence. And it says, in support, she offered her own report based on interviews with Burgess and others, the nature of his mental disorders, records regarding his past treatment, and the actuarial instruments. So it appears clear, unless that's dead wrong and the record doesn't support that, that she was using a number of things in providing that opinion to the jury. And certainly that sounds like she was offering the type of nexus that Laxton and Crane would require.
In response, I would say that if one studies carefully her report and one studies carefully her testimony, I think one would see that her testimony discussed predispositions, it discussed diagnoses, it discussed her interviews, but her conclusion as to the prediction of future dangerousness rested at the point, in other words, an expert comes in and says, I have done all of these different studies on this man, and my ultimate conclusion is that he has mental disorders and he will reoffend. But if we isolate out, where did that expert come up with, how did that expert base that expert's specific finding on the future likelihood of reoffense, we'll see that that decision flows almost exclusively from the actuarial instruments, because these doctors time and time again testify. And again, I'd just like the Court to reference the case that's being held in abeyance, because that case makes it so clear how these actuarials are used in the testimony there by different states' experts.
So the Court of Appeals counsel is wrong when they say in paragraph 27 that, you know, we've reviewed the record, we reviewed the testimony of both experts, and these opinions were based not merely on the actual actuarial instruments, but also on interviews with Burgess, his prior diagnosis, treatment records, and conversation with other professionals involved with Burgess's treatment history. So you're saying that's inaccurate.
I'm saying that that's inaccurate to the extent that if one breaks down the ultimate conclusion to see where each portion of that conclusion came from, the specific, I think that there is a 78% chance over the next 5 years that he will reoffend, that specific finding comes solely from the actuarial instruments. Certainly she discussed how these other things fit into that. But absent that, and this is where in the other case, the doctors were asked, could you make a prediction without the actuarials? And the doctor said, well, my opinion would be completely different. And then at that point, the trial court cut off further questioning about what the opinion would have been without the actuarials. But the actuarials really are the be-all and end-all of the prediction. They have said, and in fact, in Dr. Knott's testimony, at the stage of the probable cause hearing, she testified exclusively, and she said, flat out, I have based my prediction of his future likelihood of reoffending on the actuarial instruments, and I have used them because they are the only best method that we have of predicting future behavior. Otherwise, we're just guessing. And that testimony is found at Record 26 at page 22. It's the probable cause hearing. And it's Dr. Knoth's testimony in response to questions by the state prosecutor. And even in this case, the state prosecutor, and I set this out in my brief, when he argued to the jury, he breaks the case down into separate issues. He said, well, we have mental diagnosis and a qualifying mental disorder. That's the term of art we use. We have a qualifying mental disorder. And then he argues to the jury, we have actuarial data, irrefutable actuarial data that shows a substantial probability. No one in this case or in any of these cases ever says this mental disorder creates that substantial probability, because the substantial probability comes from documents that don't ask a mental health question.
Are you essentially arguing that that trying these cases on the basis of sort of plugging the respondent into these various mental health instruments, diagnostic and predictive instruments, is, as a matter of law, insufficient?
Yes, absolutely, because they do not take into consideration any mental disorder. So how can we have separating out, as Crane said and as this Court said in Laxton, we must separate out the ordinary criminal recidivist who will reoffend from the mentally ill person who will reoffend because of an inability to control behavior.
So the problem is that it's too generalized, it's not individual?
The problem is it doesn't ask a single question about mental health tied to the likelihood of future offense.
It's just a recidivism.
Exactly.
Exactly. Recidivism.
We're measuring only general recidivism. And if there's no mental health questions on those charts, how can they separate out the ordinary criminal from the mentally ill criminal and come up with a prediction of future dangerousness? They can't. Same people, profoundly mentally ill people, score exactly the same. Age, number of victims, prior offense.
So it's not a sufficiency of the evidence argument.
It is in the context of this particular case, but it's also in this Court's lawmaking function an argument that requires an evaluation of, in the real world, how are we doing these cases?
Well,
and that's why I asked the Court to consider along with this case.
Efficiency, if you knock out all of that evidence, you have nothing else.
I think
not
that's
enough.
Correct. I agree with that, Your Honor.
In fact, you said, say, let's knock that out because constitutionally it doesn't fit. Now you're not left with enough. Now you've got 5 minutes.
And I think we need to talk about the Indian.
About 13 other issues.
I realize that. I usually talk fast. I'm trying to go a little slower today.
Which issues are you trying to avoid talking about?
None of them. I'd love to have a couple of hours with you this morning. I don't think anybody else would like
pick
that.
Pick your top one.
I think we need to speak about the Indians. I'll just very momentarily brush on the privacy and confidentiality issue, which I think is very important, because if these really are non-punitive civil mental commitments, and these are mentally ill people that we're treating, then there's absolutely no reason to stigmatize them, to create public spectacles, to create news events out of these mental commitment cases. They're subject to the same reporting requirements as any other criminally convicted sex offender in the statutes. And I would strongly urge the Court to at least acknowledge that they're civil commitments to the extent that they should be closed hearings, sealed records, and initials. It doesn't exempt them from the normal criminal sex crime reporting. And with that, I'd like to talk about the Indian issue.
We can take it out. This is criminal. So if it's not, if it is criminal, the state could keep them in, right?
Absolutely.
So it's been not held not criminal, right?
Yes.
All right. So we're in civil, right?
Excuse me. Yes.
All right.
Absolutely.
Take it from there.
In this case, there are two separate issues. One is, and this is an issue that the Court of Appeals, I think, decided correctly, is that for purposes of Chapter 980, we must view Stephen Burgess as a tribal member and a permanent lawful resident of his Indian tribal reservation land. And tribal reservation lands are very special places. They're in the United States for all purposes. They're inside the state of Wisconsin sometimes. They're in the state of Wisconsin for the purposes of criminal law, criminal cases. In the 980 commitment situation, if indeed these are civil, as Justice Abrahamson said, then we have to find a basis for the state to assert its jurisdiction over this tribal reservation Indian to civilly commit him. And our position is that Public Law 280, which is the sole measure of the state's authority, does preclude and does not allow the state of Wisconsin to exercise its sovereign power in a civil regulatory setting an Indian.
Before you hit 280, I was somewhat persuaded by the state's first argument that he's in a state prison and he's going out. Are you going to address that at all?
Oh, surely, if you'd like me to. I agreed with the Court of Appeals addressed that, and the Court of Appeals found that the statute 980.105, which specifically states how do we determine a person's residence under this chapter, and they made it very clear, the legislature did, that for purposes of these cases, residence is not the institution. Residence is not where the person is held against his will by the government, but rather that because what we're looking into here is an ongoing mental condition predicated by dangerous acts, we go back to where that mental condition existed and where those acts were committed. And that's what the Court of Appeals found. That's what the statute says. And I completely agree with that. He's done nothing. In other words, he was taken off the reservation under the criminal jurisdiction of Public Law 280. And he was held against his will for one purpose by the state, which the state had lawful authority from United States Congress to do. But once the state's finished with him for that purpose, unless he's committed some other act, the state has to put him back where he was. They can't say, well, we took him for this purpose, and now we're going to keep him for a civil purpose that we have no right to do.
But what if in prison, for whatever reason, he was subjected to a Chapter 51? Where would that be held?
That, I think, would be held at the institution. There's a statute that specifically addresses that. It's Chapter 51.21(1), parentheses AR, or parentheses AV. And that type of a commitment would be premised on specific acts and upon a mental illness that struck him while he was in the state prison system, and it would have been based on something he did, an overt act that made him dangerous to himself or others while in the prison system. These 980s are completely different. These 980s, as indicated in the statute and as we all know, are completely predicated on his mental condition and the crimes he committed prior to his incarceration.
Well, Mr. Weiss, suppose that he's never been incarcerated and he's just mentally ill on and acts out on tribal land, on the reservation, and there's a 51.
Well, I think the law is quite clear that he cannot be, the state cannot enter that reservation to do a civil commitment under Chapter 51. I think that's made clear from the various attorney general's opinions, because they're not criminal in nature. We have to examine whether they're civil regulatory or not. And again,
why isn't it civil adjudicatory? Because we're adjudicating his mental health status.
Because the civil adjudicatory portion is a grant of authority by the United States Congress to allow the courts of a state to adjudicate private civil matters. And a Chapter 51 proceeding or a Chapter 980 proceeding is clearly 100% the state government asserting its sovereign government police power to detain an individual against his will. And there's no way to equate that with something which is neither civil regulatory. I'm sorry, which is civil adjudicatory.
Well, the tribe, if there's a person with a mental illness, the tribe has to set up its own hospitals or pay for somebody to go into a state hospital?
In some circumstances, that is exactly what happens. In other circumstances, the individual, the tribe, and the state by agreement have had pacts where the state will do that. And if the individual consents to it, there's no problem with it.
Well, what's your authority for saying that mental health status, aside from if it occurs in a state institution, is not subject to state control? What's your authority? Do you have a case that says mental 51 commitments are not subject to the state when it's on an Indian on Indian land at the reservation?
Yeah, I believe that the authorities, I'm just trying to find the pages in my brief where I discussed them. Most of them were from non-PL 280 states.
That's
however, the Attorney General opinions from Wisconsin that I've cited, one dealing with child custody and one dealing with mental commitments, both seem to suggest that that would be the proper result even in a PL 280 state. If the particular opinion of the Attorney General about the child custody made very clear the point that a state court could hear a private child custody dispute between two Indians who lived on the reservation, but the state could never, even in a PL 280 reservation, come in and initiate a termination or a CHIPS action, for example.
I don't know if that opinion that was covered by the Indian Child Welfare Act, but that's sort of out of this range now.
If I might, I would direct the court to examine that opinion because it was covered under both prongs, that it was not under PL 280, nor was it permitted by the Child Welfare Act. My light's been on. I don't know if the court has any other questions. I'll get out of the way.
Any further questions? Okay. Ms. Noah, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Nowak, representing the people of the state of Wisconsin. When the Circuit Court of Vilas County committed Stephen Burgess as a sexually violent person, the Circuit Court did nothing to infringe on the sovereign powers of the Lac du Flambeau tribe. In fact, the Circuit Court went above and beyond because the Circuit Court reached out to the tribal government and asked what its position was with regard to these proceedings. The tribal court told the circuit court judge that the tribe was not equipped to entertain these proceedings, and significantly that the tribe had not yet considered whether or not to enact such laws. And so the tribe itself relinquished any authority to act in this particular situation. And when I say that the circuit court went above and beyond in contacting the tribal court, that is because of the three analyses this court could employ to decide whether the circuit court's jurisdiction was proper, it is the first one, and is so often the case, the most simple route to get to the correct answer, and that is this cause of action simply did not arise in Indian country.
Where was the Court of Appeals wrong?
The Court of Appeals was wrong, and I have to acknowledge that the state's Court of Appeals brief may have led them astray in suggesting that his residence was in the prison. In fact, the legal residence of an individual is irrelevant to a jurisdictional question, and it's irrelevant on both prongs of this. First of all, legal residency has nothing to do with the Chapter 980 commitment proceedings. For example, a sex offender could commit an act in Minnesota and in Wisconsin, being a Minnesota resident, and the state could still sustain jurisdiction once it had properly exercised its criminal jurisdiction. His residence is not germane to Chapter 980 proceedings. Similarly, in Indian law jurisprudence, it is not the legal residence that is relevant. It is he a tribal member? Did the cause of action arise in Indian country, and in some circumstances, even is that Indian country within the jurisdiction of his own tribe? It has nothing to do with where he lives. For example, Mr. Burgess, though a Lac du Flambeau tribal member, may have maintained a legal residence in Milwaukee. If he was on the reservation and committed an act that would subject him to the tribal court's jurisdiction, his Milwaukee legal residence would not have any bearing on that issue. So I think the idea of him maintaining a residence on the reservation intuitively sort of makes sense, but there's no legal foundation for it.
Well, the two factors are membership in the tribe and where the conduct occurred. Is that it?
Where the cause of action arose, yes.
That's usually where the conduct occurred, but it needn't be.
Right. And in this case, at first blush, I think Mr. Weiss makes a bootstrapping argument that is, at first blush, intuitively sort of attractive. That is, the state can't go into Indian country, yank individual Indian citizens off of the reservation, and then say, now that you're within the state's jurisdiction, we're going to assert our authority over you. In fact, though, that's not what happened here. In electing to commit a crime that was lawfully within the state's criminal jurisdiction, Mr. Burgess submitted himself to the state's jurisdiction. And so this wasn't the state reaching in and doing something that purposely to get at Mr. Burgess. And after that point, Mr. Burgess is situated no differently than any other Chapter 980 subject.
Well,
that
what about a mental health, 51? Let's just take it out of 980, no crime committed, mentally ill on reservation land and a member of the tribe. Jurisdiction under 280 for the state?
Yes.
Why?
Because, a number of reasons. First, because in Bryan v. Itasca, the United States Supreme Court specifically recognized the jurisdiction of the states included access or authority to act on mental health or, insanity. Laws. Now, if you accept Mr. Weiss's proposition that the state can't act because it's a party to the action, and that's the only way his argument holds together, then you would have to just cut off those states which have assumed partial jurisdiction over subject matters wherein the state obviously had to be a petition to the action. And I'm talking specifically about the states of Idaho, Washington. Arizona has exerted authority over different sort of subject matters, but all of the subject matters laid out in those statutes necessarily involve the state as a petition to the action. And if you look at Chapter 980 in terms of statutory construction, we have an ambiguous statute, and you look at the purpose of the statute. Way back in 1953, when this was enacted, in part it was to create a forum for protection of people both on and off the reservation as a result of this lawlessness in Indian country. And that wasn't about the Indian people. That was about this tension between the financial cost to the federal government in trying to provide those services. And there, specifically in the United States Supreme Court cases, they talk about the Public Law 280 attempting to put some of the responsibility of the federal government onto the states. And the purpose was to provide protection for people on and off the reservations as a result of a lack of resources. And that is precisely the situation we have here. If you have, I don't know any tribal courts in the state that are doing Chapter 51 commitments. Now, I have not called each of the tribal governments. I don't know the answer to that. But I know that in at least three of the Public Law 280 states, that being California, Idaho, and Washington, the state routinely does the mental health commitments that would be equivalent to Chapter 51. And if what we're talking about, specifically in Chapter 980, is a situation where the state's interests are precisely the same as the tribe's. That is, we have an Indian person who is in need of treatment and who is a danger to others. If he enters the reservation, he is a risk to Indian children within that reservation, and he is thereafter free to come and go off the reservation. So his existence, his ability as an untreated sex offender to move on and off the reservation, impacts the state's interest. And that sort of takes me to the third analysis. We've talked about Public Law 280. We've talked about where the cause of action arose. Even if Public Law 280 did not give the state jurisdiction, the rule of law in this country now is that if the state's interests are sufficiently strong enough to outweigh the federal and tribal concerns, the state may exert its authority over tribal members, even in Indian country. And my authority, although there are a long line of cases, beginning in 1973 with Muscalera v. Jones, the most recent case is a 2001 case, Nevada v. Hicks. And there the court lays out specifically that we no longer have this simple view of jurisdiction that if an Indian is in Indian country, the state can't touch him. It's really about a balancing act. And in this case, again, because of the very significant nature of what we're talking about here. Someone who is already victimized by his own admission, three children, and he is untreated, that substantially the state's interests there are especially high, and especially because in this case it is the state that will have to prosecute him by virtue of Public Law 280 when he commits his next offense.
Counsel, I want to move to the issue of closed versus open hearing. It seems to me that the argument for a closed hearing, as in Chapter 51 and here Chapter 980, that the argument becomes whether an open proceeding offers the public some form of protection that outweighs the confidentiality. Recently, I was speaking with our county administrator in Marathon County. He was describing one of the issues of moment dealing with budget, and it's this. Where do you put these criminals that are picked up or charged with an offense and they're crazy? Do you take them down to the health care center? The health care center doesn't want them because they don't want to have to pay for their lodging out of their budget. Or do you take them to jail? The jail doesn't want them because they don't want to pay for it out of their budget. I say this to underscore that in regular Chapter 51s, as a circuit court judge, you deal with a lot of people who have been engaging in criminal activity. Indeed, in order to commit them, you have to find that they are either a danger to themselves or a danger to others in the public. So if you commit them based on criminal activity, their mental illness fits the categories, and they're a danger to others, why should that hearing be closed? Why should that hearing not be concerned about the danger to the public, and Chapter 980s be open because of concern for danger to the public?
Well, I have a couple of responses. And first, I think, is that we have to ask, on what authority is Mr. Weiss asking you to take action here? And if it's an equal protection argument, it doesn't matter whether you or I or anyone in this courtroom would have made a different decision. The fact is that the legislature made a decision to make Chapter 980 proceedings open to the public. And having done that, all we have to do is look for a reasonable basis. And the fact is, as this court recognized in State v. Post, that as a class, Chapter 980 committees, because they have all committed sexually violent offenses, and there is that substantial probability that they will do so in the future, are as a class more dangerous than Chapter 51 committees.
Even those committees who are committed on the basis of being a danger to others.
That's correct, as a class. So if it's an equal protection argument, they're open because the legislature had arguably a rational reason for doing so. If he's asking this court to exert its rulemaking authority over courts, I would respectfully suggest that you lack the authority to do it where the legislature has spoken otherwise. And in this case, in this state, proceedings are open to the public unless specifically provided for otherwise. This court has recognized that chapters 801 to 807 govern Chapter 980 proceedings, and in 807.04, it specifically provides that proceedings will be open to the public. And I might add that as a policy reason, when we have a statute like this that is arguably so controversial, isn't this exactly the kind of proceeding that we want open to the public? Because the public should have an investment on whether or not these proceedings are conducted fairly, whether they want to continue with this law. And so it is the public's right to have access to those proceedings, not Mr. Burgess's right to close them, that is at issue here. So I don't think that Mr. Weiss has laid out authority for this court to close those proceedings. And again, you or I or anyone else may have made a different choice, but at this point they're open.
What standard did the Court of Appeals apply?
For
keeping them open.
they used an equal protection analysis.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And specifically, I think, relying on State v. Williams.
35 says compelling interest. Strict scrutiny and a class of people that have a specific profile, namely mental illness. Well, doesn't matter. We'll reread.
Pardon me?
We'll reread that. I'm going to turn you now to the issue that the defendant counsel paid close attention to, namely these actuarial tables. Are these actuarial tables for all sex offenders, not merely those that are mentally ill?
I don't know the answer to that. What I know is that they do pertain to sexually violent persons or people who have committed sexually violent offenses and who have been incarcerated for that purpose.
So it's not limited to Chapter 980 people.
That's correct. I have no way of knowing that. But I do know, I would disagree with Mr. Weiss's statement, though, that mental illness is never an issue in the actuarials, because I know that at least one of them takes into consideration failure at past treatment, that we know that from the actuarials, from a statistical standpoint, an individual who has started but failed a treatment is statistically more likely to reoffend than one who was never offered treatment to begin with. But I think, if I could, what Mr. Weiss wanted you to look at was the real world. And every day in this state, in courtrooms, the real world is that people make inferences from the evidence, intent, for example, in any crime. And here, when he talks about blurring the issue of the mental disorder and the risk of dangerousness, what was really happening is there is an inference that the experts are first stating that this individual has a disorder which predisposes him to commit these acts. We know that he has already predicted them. The only question then is, to what degree is he likely to act on that that determination? And when we're talking about the actuarials, it's most often the experts are not relying specifically or exclusively on the actuarials. They are one piece of evidence. And I think it's State v. Keenitz that talks about that the state doesn't even have to put in actuarials or expert testimony at all, that if a jury can make the determination without those, the fact that an expert relies on actuarials in addition to the other evidence doesn't undermine the validity of the commitment.
What if it was solely actuarials, never saw the person, just read the person's record and just applied the actuarials and just relied on that? Good enough?
Well, I think that would be a credibility determination for the jury. But if there was evidence that he had a disorder that predisposed him to commit these acts and that he had in the past acted on those acts, the actuarials, remember, are not applied blindly. It is about information pertaining to this specific individual and his life and his history. So I think that potentially, yes. But you might have difficulty convincing a jury on that basis alone. And in this case specifically, the facts are so strong supporting the commitment and the fact that Dr. Fields in particular not only looked at his treatment records, talked with him, and then relied on the actuarial. She also, because his diagnosis was pedophilia, which the United States Supreme Court has, I think, recognized a distinction between pedophilia and other sort of mental health diagnoses, that they recognize sort of that pedophilia creates a stronger suggestion of that predisposition. But in this case, he also had a diagnosis of the chronic alcoholism and substance abuse and the antisocial personality disorder. And so there was more testimony than we might otherwise see about explaining how those disorders impact the likelihood that he will reoffend in the future. Because there's nothing specifically about a diagnosis of antisocial personality, for example, that would necessarily lead to a Chapter 980 commitment.
I would hope not.
Any further questions?
What's your response to the argument of opposing counsel in regard to the jury instruction? The claim is made that the jury instruction here was the standard instruction, but was insufficient because of the reliance allegedly on actuarial instruments. Do you have any response to that?
I think he's flat out wrong. That first of all, the jury instruction, I guess that's not surprising, but the jury instruction that he requested was an instruction telling the jury that they had to find a complete lack of control. That is the jury instruction that was requested, and that was patently dealt with in both Crane and Laxton, that an absolute ability to or lack of control is not required.
Are you satisfied the jury instruction, the pattern instruction, was appropriate here?
Yes, yes. It did exactly what is required under the law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Noah. Mr. Weiss?
Thank you. I'll begin by addressing a little bit more detail on the Indian jurisdictional issue. It's our position that Indian law, as it's developed from the United States Supreme Court, does not actually leave it up to the state nor the tribe to determine under what circumstances the state may assert what we call its sovereign police power over reservation tribal residents. The case law has made it very clear that before the state can act, and this goes to the section of the brief where I've criticized or suggested that this court's jurisprudence in Chapman and Webster needed to be reexamined, particularly in line with it was Justice Heffernan's dissent in the Chapman case. I believe Justice Abrahamson had joined in, and the trial judge, Judge Moore, who, as this court's well aware, does a huge amount of the state, federal, tribal jurisdictional work because of the location of his court, even suggests that we have a problem here and we haven't really been adhering to the standard mode of analysis. That mode of analysis says that before the state can act, the state has to point to a specific grant of authority from the United States Congress. It's not a situation where, well, the tribe's not doing it, so somebody has to. What are we going to do? There's a vacuum. The state can't fill vacuums on Indian land. The state could contract with the tribe at the tribe's desire to fill vacuums. The state can fill vacuums if Congress has authorized it to, as it did with the criminal jurisdictional prong of Public Law 280. It said, if it's a crime state, you're free to go in there and enforce it. But in these cases, number one thing to remember is involuntary mental commitments are an exercise of the sovereign power of the state over an individual. Addington versus Texas, cited in my brief, makes it very clear it's the police power of the state that allows the state to do that. The civil grant of jurisdiction in Public Law 280 specifically has been determined by the U.S. Supreme Court time and time again not to allow the sovereign power of the state, even in a civil forum, to be exercised over individuals who are reservation residents and tribal members.
So why does this not fit within Public Law 280's grant of civil jurisdiction?
Because as I was trying, that's exactly what I was trying to say, was because these commitments involve the exercise of the state's sovereign police power, they are not covered by the civil jurisdiction prong. The civil jurisdiction prong is to provide a state court forum for, quote, private disputes, unquote. And there is nothing about an involuntary Chapter 980 mental commitment where the government takes an individual, places him in a government-run institution, and holds him there until the government decides to let him go that could possibly be described as a private civil dispute between private parties.
Well, Section 1360A says that the civil laws of the state that are of general application to private persons or private property, which is not involved here, shall have the same force and effect.
Yes, and as I said in my brief, I won't belabor the point in rebuttal at this short time, that clause has been interpreted by the United States Supreme Court, by virtually every federal circuit court, by every writer of Indian law scholarship and law reviews, as saying the civil laws apply to the extent that they pertain to private litigative disputes. In other words, rules of evidence would apply. If the two Indians are having a child custody dispute and they choose to go to state court with it, the state court can hear that and it can apply state law to that private dispute. But it's never been held anywhere that the state can exercise its regulatory authority under that civil prong.
So wherever the state is a party in a civil action, Public Law 280 does not apply? Is that
no, true? If the state were suing somebody perhaps over tort damage, a contract, it would certainly apply. But if the state wants to come in and say, we're the state and we're taking you and putting you in an institution, that's the police power of the state. The state's not a civil litigant in that case. The state is exercising its sovereign power as a government. And the power of the government is not part of the civil branch of Public Law 280. And every case that's ever addressed that has said that.
Mr. Weiss, I'm not quite sure I understand what you're saying could happen to an Indian who happens to have happens to be a sexual predator.
He would be penalized by the state, so far as the state is permitted to do that under its criminal laws.
But I mean, you
we had 150 years of sex crimes in Wisconsin without doing anything like Chapter 980, and an Indian who's a reservation resident would be treated just as we treated all the citizens of the state prior to the enactment of 980.
So we would have to wait for additional sexual assaults before acting.
Yeah, we'd have to wait till somebody committed a crime and then punish him for what they do rather than anticipatorily civilly committing him for what he might or might not do in the future, yes.
Unless the Indian tribe passed it.
That would be a yes, of course.
And then contract with the state to use a state institution.
I think that's absolutely correct.
I think that would work.
I think that's correct. I think the tribe would have the right to decide if they wanted to take that route or if the tribe was satisfied with letting the criminal law run its course. And people commit crimes, pay the price for those crimes, and then they go on about their business.
But why isn't that... Isn't this, see it, a member of the tribe who's been committed for a sexually violent act? Then, if you're right, they're not committed under 980. They go back and live on the tribe. But then, once they wander out, you think that they can't be hit under either 51 or 980. That's your, well, 980 because you have a limited time. But you can't get them under 51 either.
For overt acts committed off the reservation?
Yes.
Oh,
for
I think
on the reservation. You cannot have a civil commitment.
I do not believe the state can exercise its civil sovereign police powers on an Indian reservation, period.
As I understood your opposing counsel's comment, she listed a few states where she thought that indeed they did exercise Chapter 51 on reservations and there was a specific grant of authority.
My belief, and I'm not certain of those specifics, I don't think they were addressed particularly in the brief, is that if they're doing that with the consent of the tribes.
Well, here, didn't you have the consent of the tribe? Didn't Judge Moore ask?
No, Judge Moore asked. Judge Moore was operating under this Court's pronouncements in Chapman and Webster, which, as I've argued, I think are incorrect. To the extent of if there's a vacuum, the state is free to act. And Judge Moore wrote the letter to the courts and said, are you acting, can you act, do you want to act? And the judge said, not now, but maybe in the future, was the response. And based upon that, Judge Moore said, well, given that vacuum, I'm not going to force this on the tribe, and I believe under Chapman and Webster, I must act in the vacuum. And then he went on in that discussion that I've referred to in the brief and reprinted in the appendix to say, I don't really think we should be doing this, but the Supreme Court said we can and we should, so we will, until somebody tells me otherwise.
I think your opposing counsel used the phrase that the tribe itself relinquished jurisdiction. Can the tribe relinquish jurisdiction on something like this, or is it more of an individual right?
It's either an individual right or it's the right of the United States government. In other words, the state and the tribe don't get to sit down with each other in most cases and simply agree who does what. It's all ultimately comes back to Public Law 280, because the tribes are subordinate only to the federal government, and the states are off to the side. So the relationship goes federal government, Indian tribes, over here is the state, and the state can act on the Indian tribes only to the extent that the federal government permits it. And I think that's...
But to put this...
So I don't think the tribe can offer the state jurisdiction. It could contract for services.
Put this very bluntly. State of Wisconsin, in your view, the state of Wisconsin may civilly commit people under Chapter 51 if they're white, black, Asian American, Latino, but not if they are Native Americans living on the reservation, and the same thing is true under Chapter 980.
If I'm understanding your question, yes. Let me just make sure I understood it. If they're a legal resident and they've chosen not to live in the state of Wisconsin, but the tribal member has chosen to live on the tribal land, the answer is yes, the state cannot act. If that's exactly what you're asking.
Do they get to vote in the state of Wisconsin?
I believe they have dual citizenship to the extent that they can vote, yes. The states have to provide rights and services, but that state cannot exercise its police power over those people unless it's within the scope of the authority granted by Congress. It's a very special situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Thank you, Mr. Nowak. And that concludes our hearing in 00-3074. In re commitment of Stephen Burgess. Now we're going to take a few moments in recess to allow the students who wish to leave to leave. There will be another group coming in at 10:45, and don't forget to come back at about 12 to 12:15, and you will be meeting with Justice Bradley. We're in recess.
Here. Yeah, I'm not good.